Yes, well, we should talk about that sometime.
You are technological.
Okay, fine.
Well, we are going to proceed with the second part, so to speak, of the same and unique energy. Thank you.
Okay. I was obviously talking this morning about, I suppose, the separateness between writing music for film and writing music for the concert hall, for the opera house, but this really isn't a separation at all, because I tend to, and I'm fortunate in that the music that I write for a film can become part of the concert music, as I demonstrated yesterday and as I showed today, and music that I've written for the concert hall has also become part of film scores. There is a film by Peter Greenaway called The Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover, El Cocinero, something, whatever. And there's a very famous piece of music in that. Etc., etc. That is a piece of music that is totally integrated in the film, defines the film, defines your response to the film, defines the way the film wants to present itself, and you may say that this is very clever of the composer to be able to make a piece of music which works so well in the film. And I would contradict that by saying that it's very clever of the film director to have taken a piece of music by me that I'd already written for the concert hall and to build his film around it. So what we have is a is a situation where there's a constant moving of music from film into the concert hall, which I play in the concert hall, and moving music from the concert hall into film. The story behind that piece, Memorial, is complicated again, but quite simple. I read the script of The Cook. Peter Greenaway came to my house and we started talking about the music, and I said, how do you conceive the music for this film? How do you want it to sound? How do you want it to feel? And he gave me a very detailed description of a very specific kind of music that he wanted, and I took a cassette off my shelf and I played it to him and I said, you mean you want a piece of music like this? And he listened to it and he said, yeah, that's exactly what I want. What is it? And I said, this is a piece that I wrote 4 years earlier, a piece called Memorial, that I wrote as a homage, as a memorial piece for the 39 Juventus football fans who were killed in the Hazel Stadium. And accidentally, I'd written a piece of music which Peter Greenaway had described, an imaginary piece of music that he described to me, and that he didn't know that I'd written and that he'd never heard. And he said, well, that's amazing. Can you write me a piece of music that is like this for the film? And I said, no, and he said, why? And I said, well, if I write something that's like this piece, it won't be this piece, and a lot of the characteristics that you really like will be transformed or softened or emphasized or whatever. And I said, take this recording and use this piece. So, so the piece you hear in that film is not only the composition that I composed, but it's also the recording. Is a re-recording of the recording that I made in the first performance. Quite often when you're working with a director and the director becomes very attached to a piece of your music, piece of my music, and he's too shy, like Christopher Hampton was too shy with Carrington. He was really a string quartet that I wrote based on the piece you're going to hear later called Out of the Ruins, he thought was extremely and beautifully suitable for his film Carrington. And he kept asking me to make make a piece that was like the string quartet. And I said, look, Christopher, what you really want, you really want this piece, don't you? And he said, yes, I'd love to have the piece, but it's a concert piece. It has a certain kind of identity in the concert hall. And he didn't have the courage to ask me. And I said, look, if that piece works very well for you, again, the same principle with the Greenaway, whatever changes I make are going to be wrong, take that piece. Now, the interesting thing about music, I mean, maybe we can discuss this philosophically, is that the origins of that piece is the piece tonight called Out of the Ruins. Out of the Ruins was written for an Armenian television documentary, well, an English television documentary about the Armenian earthquake. I then made a kind of transcription of it for string quartet, and I fed into the string quartet Romanian folk music because it was basically a celebration of the downfall of Ceausescu. So to me, this piece is very Eastern European, very kind of Balkanic, and yet Christopher Hampton's film Carrington is about English society in the 1920s, English literary society, English upper middle class British people in the 1920s in London and around London, and yet the piece of music, which to me had all these non-British, Central European, Eastern European cultural references, gave it a kind of dimension which allowed it to exist in various different time zones and also historical zones and also geographical spaces simultaneously. One of the things that I just answered a question about TV3 about writing operas and writing music for film and what the difference is, and the basic difference is the amount of music you write for a film is limited, the amount of music you write for an opera is unlimited. The choices you make for an opera are choices that are totally my choices, that are never questioned by a second person. You never have to discuss. With a film director, you're constantly discussing what the music does, where it does it, how long it does it for, what the character of the music is, what it expresses. There's a constant dialogue. And constant kind of critical dialogue. Yes, this is perfect. No, I don't like this. This doesn't work for me. Can you change this? You're constantly having to delete things, to adjust things, to rewrite things, to fit the picture, which is constantly changing, or to agree with the taste of the director. When I write an opera, it's just me. So that even though the person who writes the script, the libretto, feels that he should have or she should have an input into what the composer does with his or her words, I basically say, opera is my medium, fuck off, excuse me. I know best. And it may be true, may not be true, but that's the position I take. Occasionally, a director will say to me, will give me the opportunity to write a piece of music which is totally self-contained. Peter Greenaway made a film in 1979, 3 years before the Glassons contract, called The Falls, and it was 92 biographies of 92 imaginary characters. And one of the characters was a singer, and she sang a song which just consisted of the names of birds. And he said to me, Michael, will you write the song for the singer? For the singer, for the character. And so I did, and since the music was the performance, and the performance was the music, and the film produced the song was literally the film of the performance, it was just basically a song which could have been in an opera or could have been in a song cycle. It just happened to be in the film. And what I did was what I'm getting around to is to, this afternoon I want to take two pieces of music and demonstrate two different ways of creating a musical continuity. One piece happened to come from a film and the other piece happened to come from an opera. So what I decided was that since when you make a list of birds' names or of everything, everything has the same quality, everything is equal. You know, the name of this bird may have more syllables, but otherwise, or may be more rare than another bird, but there seems no reason to create anything other than just a pure kind of straightforward listen. So I decided that the bird names would all be sung on one note. So the singer sings one note. And the instrumentalists, I decided that that for some reason, I don't know where this idea comes from, that there will be four chords that we call dominant sevenths. That's called a dominant seventh. And I discovered that there were four dominant sevenths that each have the note A. So the singer just sings that one note. And she sings different birds' names. The violin player, I mean, the piano does. The piano does that, just repeating those four bars until the piece ends. The violins play. And all the other instruments in the Michael Nyman band at the time play melodies which which during the course of the piece start very empty and gradually fill in the gaps between the notes, and they combine themselves with the harmony, but they don't really need to combine themselves with themselves. So basically you have something that is absolutely fixed, and you have these evolving melodies. Now this is a way that we wrote music in the 70s and 80s, and as a kind of serious piece, or a serious representative of a piece that just presents one process. So it's like going on a train journey. There are no deviations. The texture gradually gets more and more. Certain things in the texture remain the same, and the rest of the texture just gets fuller and fuller and fuller. And at some point, within the kind of game of composing, when all the instruments have finished playing their melody, have got to the end of their complete melody, then I just stop. So it's a combination of what is fixed, what is changing, what is controlled, what is uncontrolled, and a kind of a random duration, because the piece, as I say, stops when the players have got to the end of their melody, and they are allowed to decide how many times they play each of their four measure melodies. And I have a version here, which we will hear now, if somebody could switch it on, where the voice part is replaced by a trumpet. So you don't hear the words, but you do hear... Now where's my operator when I need an operator? Can you track one? Thank you. So theoretically, that is a piece that can that has no fixed duration. That version is 3 minutes, but if you choose to take longer over the gradual revealing of these melodies, the saxophones and the brass instruments, it could be 10 minutes. It could indeed be 2 hours, although you'd be crazy to play it for 2 hours because the violinists would not be able to do it, and the wind players would be very unhappy. So that's a kind of closed form, but an open form. Now, we talked this morning about originality. Now, I have proof that this sequence of four chords has never ever been put together as a sequence in the whole history of music. Now, how do I have this proof? There is an American rock group, and since this camera is running, I won't name the rock group, who stole my piece, stole this piece of music, and made a song out of it. Right? And a very, very famous rock group who sold millions of copies of this album with this song. And the song used not only these harmonies, but also used the same tempo, used the same, except I have 8 beats in each measure, they had 4, so they would. So their piece was theoretically twice as fast as mine. And what happens in these legal cases is that I have to prove, or the people representing me, I have to prove that the piece of music by this group, let's say for the sake of argument, a group like the Scissor Sisters, that their only source of for their choice of these four chords was my piece. So what then happens is musicologists are employed by both sides, by my side defending me, and by the side of the, let's say for example, the Scissor Sisters, and these musicologists make it their business to say, well, both Mr. Nyman and the group, let's say for example the Scissor Sisters, have gone back to a previous source, right? So the musicologist spends all his time finding what the previous source is, just to prove that it is impossible to prove that this group listened to my piece, because they could have been listening to the same piece that I listened to. And this musicologist spent a long, long, long time, and he said, not in the history of music have I found this particular chord sequence. It is possible that this same chord sequence exists, but he hasn't found it. So it seemed very unlikely that this group, let's call them the Scissor Sisters, had gone back to a source prior to my source. Now, what's interesting about this chord sequence, and I'm obviously kind of obsessed with harmony, is that I created it artificially. Here was a note, and I wanted 4 chords that all each contain that note. And so I just created out of instinct, or created, no, less out of instinct, just artificially created this chord sequence, which is unique to the history of music, and I have proof thereof. Any questions so far this afternoon? How are we doing for time? Fine. Now, there is another... What I was saying earlier about the music for Carrington, which started as... The music for Carrington started from out of the ruins, became a string quartet, then became Carrington, is that, and again this is a kind of philosophical discussion that I don't have time to talk about now, you know, what is the identity of a musical idea? Is the identity contained in the invention of a musical idea, or is the identity contained in the use and sometimes reuse of that idea? And in my career as a film composer, I have... One of the things that happens when you write film music is sometimes they say, yes, please, Mr. Nyman, we would like your music for this film. And they listen to the music and they say, no, thank you, Mr. Nyman, we don't want your music. So then you have spent a lot of time, or a short amount of time, writing the music for the film that the director or the producer or the production company or the studio doesn't want. What do you do with it? What do you do with that music? Well, you don't throw it away, obviously. You use it for something else. So it's a bit like a kind of geographical transmigration of peoples and languages. I could take you through some pieces of mine and say, this idea started here, it moved here, I then took it from here, and then it became this. So it's a bit like, so musical material is actually very nomadic. And wherever it stops, it defines perfectly what it is and what that location is, but then it moves on. And sometimes when it moves on, it changes and becomes something else. There was a film, there's a rather controversial American director called Todd Solondz, who made a film called Happiness, which was about, it's about 10 years ago and is about pedophilia, amongst other things. And he wanted me to write the music for this film. And he showed me the film, and he played me the kind of music that he was looking for. And it was slightly cheap 60s music, very difficult to define. When he left, I wrote music that I thought would be suitable, and this is another thing that film directors do a lot. This afternoon I'm talking about film. You have a director in your house, you play the music, this is wonderful music. The director takes the music away, plays it in his house or in her house, and says, Mr. Nyman, the music that I said was wonderful this morning, I think is really terrible, write something else. So I had Todd Solondz, who was a very nervous little man, in my house, and I played him this music, and he was very happy with it. He went back to New York, and I never heard from him again. Because directors also change their mind about music. So when Todd Solondz first approached me, I had no idea what kind of music he wanted, so I sent him a piece of music that was actually a slowed down version of this. Or something like that. So it sounded like Mozart, but wasn't Mozart. And I sent him this just in order to establish what linguistic area we were considering. And he said, no, I don't want anything like this. I want this kind of 60s cheap lounge music. So I wrote my version of cheap 60s lounge music, and it wasn't cheap enough. And so he didn't use it, and then I didn't bother to see the film. And a friend of mine saw the film, and I said, what music did he use? And the friend said, Mozart. So directors are, right. So the cheap music I wrote consisted of three or four different ideas. That's two bars, and then a third idea. And that was all I notated, because it never got as far as writing anything serious. Then there was another idea, which was this, which is a bit like Bernard Herrmann. Oh no. Ooh, no. Ooh, that's very strange. Oh, a minute. Or whatever, you'll hear it. I can't. It's something like that. This music just stayed in my cupboard for 4 years. And 2 or 3 years ago, I was asked to write an opera. And it's a love story. And it's a love story about a professor of mathematics who meets a boxer who is no longer able to perceive the world clearly. And she trains him into regaining his mind through mathematics, and they have a love affair. And there's a scene where she sings, I've tried to tell you what I think, that you've taken too many punches to take any more. That is the truth. You've been hit in too many places, etc., etc., etc. And I thought it would be very interesting to take these musical fragments that I wrote for this film director and to build a structure which is totally the opposite of the structure you just heard. The structure you just heard is basically one straight line. We start here, the chords continue, and you gradually get bigger like that, but everything, the direction is a straight line. And here I've created something where these little components etc. etc. are pieced together very, very much in a way of a kind of very highly edited juxtaposition process with a voice part added. Now I just want you to listen to this. It's about 9.5 minutes, and although I say this myself, I think what this scene does is what opera music should do. So we'll just play that, track 8. Please don't go, don't go. We need track 8. Track 8 at this point.
I've tried to tell you what I think, that you've taken too many punches to take anymore.
say that nothing hurts. And for some reason that I don't understand, why you can't lift your face in the night and make her cry like a fox. Maybe said more ladylike than that, I'm putting a key in a lock, and yes, the lock turns, but the door sticks like it's blocked by a bag of sand. So there's a kid who wants me to put him through his pain. Cash in hand, and after the session, when we are done, he'll know just how much I can take, and I'll know exactly what he's got because he's given me his all. I will tell the governor how far he might go, and it's not to some unknown place where no. Lock. And yes, the lock turns, but the door sticks
Okay, so that's quite a complex structure. And not only does it refer to itself, but also refers to two other main parts of material from the rest of the octave. And also, so it gives me as a composer something that I can't really do in film, the ability to manipulate time, manipulate space, manipulate memory, to create out of quite uninteresting material, a kind of artificial structure which acts as a kind of bed for the singer to sing over. Sometimes she sings independently of what you hear in the orchestra, and sometimes she kind of joins in with the melodies that you become familiar with. Now I'm very proud of this. This is something very different from anything I've done before. And just makes it more frustrating that I can't be writing operas three times a year as I can be writing film scores three times a year. But again, that has a lot to do with, with the position, with the frequency of films being made and the infrequency of new operas being made. But that's a kind of social, cultural question that we should leave for another time. Now, there must be some questions, because we are now very close to... Does anyone have any questions?
I do have... Oh, sorry. I do have one.
Yes. That doesn't surprise me.
Sorry?
That doesn't surprise me.
You are talking about musical ideas. And my question is, how do you feel more comfortable when you react with a musical idea to a non-musical event, story, yeah, or something like that? Or when do you produce the musical idea out of itself, so to speak?
Well, I mean, that's very interesting because... what fascinated me about this opera sequence was the fact that for the film I'd written a kind of few microseconds of music, but because I used, as you say, or as you imply, because I'd used the text as a means of generating and regenerating the material, and the text, I mean, sometimes the text fits beautifully, so when you say you forgive me, it sounds as though I had written the music for the text, but in fact I had adjusted music that already existed around the text. Now this thrills me, because I think every compositional situation, we are, what I was saying this morning, there are two ways of dealing with this. You know, one way is the musical structuring process is generated from inside, and at other times it's generated from outside. And here this was generated by the outside, but in a way that sometimes you can hear that it's from the outside, and sometimes you think it's from the inside. The previous piece I played, again, that material is structured from the outside, but it's also structured by something that is within its own, I mean, it has a process built in a way to its own culture, and its internal culture. And if one of the problems with anything that we create has to do with what actually stimulates an idea, and once the idea exists, what actually helps us to create a continuity with that idea, then we're constantly looking out, outside means of generating length. So as I said before this morning, you know, there would be to create music by analogy, by, I mean, the Greenaway situation of 12 drawings of the Grassmann's contract, each having six stages of evolution, that immediately is an external idea. And sometimes it's very difficult to decide which is which. And sometimes I just sit down and allow the musical idea to generate its own motion and to generate its own developmental process, and especially when it's a melody. There's nothing external. There's nothing external in the organization of that melody. It's just the way that my ear is, the way that it should progress. But sometimes something can sound completely natural, like the other tune from Gattaca. It's a melody that just grew and evolved out of its own internal dynamic. But that actually, how that piece came about was there was another sequence in the film that had music that had one part of the film and completely transformed it by letting it generate a totally different melody. So, you know, we could sit down with every piece I've written and it would be fascinating because what interests me, I think you will have gathered this morning, this afternoon, is the making process. And where the ideas come from is one thing, what you do with them is another thing, how they present themselves to the world is a third thing in performance. And if I lost that curiosity about what one can do with musical material, then I would stop composing. As I stop talking. If I stop talking, no.
Yeah. Well, that's for me, a very difficult question. The limits of significance of music. I mean, in language it happens. A language can have different, the same sentence can have different uses.
Sure.
In that sense, different meanings, but not all possible meanings.
No.
Someone comes to you and after listening to your music says, "No, Mr. Nyman, I don't accept your music for my film." Well, in the contrary sense, what would you accept? I mean, as a limit. I mean, imagine that someone hears your music and tries to put some text to your music. Is everything acceptable? And how do you? What's the criteria?
Well, it's very interesting. And I return to what I said about the Beatles this morning, because the Beatles have allowed this new remix called Love to be used by Cirque du Soleil in Las Vegas. And I was reading an article over lunch by an English critic who said that the Beatles never allowed their music to be used in conjunction with any advertising whatsoever. And nor did Tom Waits. And certainly John Lennon would never have performed and I would never be like Elvis, I would never have performed in Las Vegas. Now, I do allow my music to be used for TV commercials, because I actually think, and maybe this is a spurious argument, I think that where my music comes from, it comes from, you know, the classical, you know, it comes from Baroque music, it comes from John Cage, it comes from Steve Reich, it comes from the post-modern tradition. And basically, if an advertising agency wants a piece of music by me, I'm allowing this music to infiltrate and to invade a world that has nothing, that my music has nothing to do with. So I find that, you know, my melodies are my particular ways of structuring, which are not conventional ways of structuring. So the kind of the aesthetic of my music and the form of the music and the dynamic of the music suddenly comes out of a television set, you know, maybe advertising Toyota or advertising something even worse. And there's a strange sense of pride that I have got under the skin of the commercial world and the commercial musical world by remaining very honest to my musical means of production. Now you may think, you could all say that I'm deluding myself and basically what I'm doing is selling art to the commercial world, but I know that every time I've done a TV ad, I've never had to compromise my working methods, and the same with film. And the fact that the music, as I say, can shift from film to stage to opera and from the concert hall back into film shows me that I have a kind of consistency of procedure that I like to think is, as I say, scrupulously honest. But it does amuse me to you know, this. I mean, that piece of music is constantly used on television without my control by the BBC for sport, for everything. It is also used when it's associated with politicians. Politicians that whose politics I don't agree with, and I have no control over that. And at that point, I find the availability and the freedom of the music offensive, or the way that it's being used. So it's a kind of mixed blessing. So, girls, do you have a question? Yes, good.
I don't understand the question. Yeah. No entenc gaire la pregunta perquè, esclar, ell no pot pas decidir qui l'escolta.
No, no, no. La seva decisió és quan està composant.
Sí. Sí, ah. Sí, sí, també té present la situació del contemporani que l'escoltarà.
Yo tengo que decir
Well, perhaps I'm not sure I caught the question, but I think that she's playing with the idea of time.
Yes.
You have a very close relationship with time. I mean, traditional time with the mm-hmm. with the cultural tradition mm-hmm. or with the different places in the world, and you put into this some new tradition, etc. So mm-hmm. that time is controlled by you. And then she asks, are you also considering the time of the audience, not just the time of composing, of including different things, of mixing, of doing, but the time of
yeah.
the audience that that is listening?
Well,
at this.
I subconsciously, because I mean, I have been to a lot of concerts where I'm astonished by the arrogance of the composer taking up too much of my time on music that isn't very interesting. So there's a lot of music I listen to, especially minimal music and especially some kind of world music, where the time that the music occupies doesn't justify being spent on the lack of inventiveness of the material. Now, I hope that instinctively what I do captures your attention strongly enough and for the correct length of time for the material to justify that attention. And this is something I don't think any composer really thinks about that. But I've not, I mean, people have problems with my music as a kind of genre. Like, for instance, those people I mentioned this morning who couldn't listen to for more than 20 seconds, they would find everything that I write is inappropriate for their sense of time. But people who basically like my music or like the genre of music, I'm very rarely have they said that piece would have been wonderful if it had been 5 minutes shorter. So I seem to be able, with myself as a kind of guide audience, instinctively to know how to spread the material out in time in front of the audience. And I think that I have a particular trick of writing that even if something is too long, at least your attention is captured for the length of that time. Very difficult to say. It depends how you listen. The reason I played these two pieces this afternoon are that an audience that likes the kind of traditional Michael Nyman would find this piece very compulsive listening, and that audience would find this piece would find the structuring process very obtrusive. They wouldn't know how to locate themselves within the structure of the piece. Whereas a piece that just goes like this is very familiar to, you know, everyone that loves minimal music. And listening either to Phil Glass or Steve Reich, the music does that, or it may do that. But a piece of music where there's a slightly more complex relationship between the components, the real Michael Nyman fans find it very, very difficult to locate the geography of the piece. And also that, in addition to having operatic voices, is also, you know, a cultural difficulty. You know, you hear that piece and you hear it says, I am an opera, and people have a problem with opera. And they have problems with certain kinds of culturally trained voices. But as a composer, I find it very difficult to write the old style of continuously evolving music. You know, that's what I was doing 20 years ago. And now I seem only to write this very artificially constructed. I mean, this is literally constructed. You know, rather than so. So whereas the earlier music is a bit like a kind of natural phenomenon, you know, it goes on and on and on, like a force of nature. This other music is very much like a piece of architecture. It's very built. And kind of gives you it gives you more options, because I'm creating the options for listening, but also gives you fewer options because I have created the structure. I have created a little town, and you have to walk, unfortunately you have to walk around this little town according to the plan that I've composed. Whereas in this piece, it's an open field, and you can really follow your own progress around.
Are you saying that Michael Nyman is losing fans when he gets more complex?
Yeah, there are people.
That's
that,
what.
That, yeah, there are people that there are my fans who don't like my operas.
Yeah,
but that's tough. Yeah. That's tough. Maybe, but also by the same token, there are fans of my operas who wouldn't like. They would find that kind of rather mindless. So, whatever, you know, I'm a fan of both.
Yeah.
Okay.
¿Alguna pregunta?
When you're composing something,
are
you based on human feeling or something like that?
And what feeling?
If you're based on images or...
Or you just sit in front of the piano and you have
it
and you create something and then you realize that has been something to do with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's basically the process of... I never write music which has to do with my feelings. I mean, I've written very sad music when I've been very happy, very depressed, very happy music when I've been depressed. And again, if you write music for opera or for film, then you can't only write love music when you're in love, otherwise, you know, you'd never write anything. So it is a kind of, it is a process whereby I invent and observe and manipulates the musical material, sometimes for its own sake, sometimes as just a kind of a game of composition. And I kind of look at it, and as I said this morning, once the game is over, I actually observe what game have I created and what is the effect of this game. And the wonderful thing about writing music, as distinct from working with ideas or working with language, is that each piece of music, and no piece of music has to conform to a particular alphabet, to a particular linguistic construct. It doesn't have to, they don't have to be complete sentences. And if there are complete sentences, they don't need to make sense. And this is entirely personal to me. You know, if I was writing in the 18th century, you know, if you listen to Mozart and Haydn, you know, then there's a kind of language construct that you personalize, but basically you all had to play the same game. You know, we're fortunately in this kind of market, you know, creative market economy where, you know, I create my own personal rules, my own personal language. I just have a dialogue with myself. Unfortunately, the dialogue that I have with myself is also communicating with you guys, but then the question is, and we don't have time to talk, what is being communicated? Because I'm not saying anything to you. All I'm saying is, here is this object I've created. But it does say something to you. You know, whether saying is the right word, I don't know. Something is transferred from here
through your ears, etc., etc.
Very interesting. It's a lovely job. I mean, it's a wonderful.
Absolutely.
It's a wonderful. Yeah.
Associo questa musica alla mia espressione del mondo dal romano catalano e dal celeste. Sì.
He associates your music with Catalan architecture, Romanic Catalan.
Victor is a young and I was thinking of
Well, he is thinking of painting, mm-hmm. of this Romanic yeah. painting.
And then in the second music, un acto di unità, un primitivismo intenzionale.
He sees in your music a wished and expressed primitivism, mm-hmm. like the painters in the medieval age.
Mm-hmm.
He's a musician uh-huh. himself.
yeah.
yeah, this would be what marks you, what gives mm-hmm. you. Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah. This would make difference with Rush, with Glass.
Sure.
Now two questions. That was just the
prologue.
The introduction.
Yeah. This what you do according to his vision responds to your nature of a musician, or it's something calculated and
it's both kind of sensual and intellectual. It's both imaginative, and I use my imagination. Also, I work. So some things, as I say, come from some kind of musical instinct, and some things sound instinctive when they're not. Or there's a combination of something that is structured and something that is instinctive. So we have these harmonies. That's fixed. But the tune sounds purely instinctive. So there's a combination of something that is
nature,
something that is instinctive, and something where the game that I've forced myself to play, the rules are very strict. And the rules of that piece are, here is this chord sequence, I'm not going to change anything. So even if I find a melody that seems to want to go in a different direction, I'm not going to take it in that direction, because, you know, I've laid down tram lines. And sometimes I do go in another direction. Sometimes I, you know, as I say, when I'm improvising into the computer, I allow the instinctive and the instinctual to take over from the controlled. Because sometimes I think there's too much control. And I think, like all of us, we all want to do things that we don't allow ourselves to do. And, you know, I'm in a fortunate position that I can write a different piece of music, you know, which appears to contradict the previous piece of music. So I allow myself to do that. But I know that it's all kind of confined within whatever definition of Michael Nyman the composer is, but what's interesting, I mean, like philosophers, you know, we kind of start with a set of invented or given facts, and we spend our lives exploring them, and sometimes something from the outside forces you to make an exploration to go in a direction that you never expected. So, because the nature of the film, the piano, required me to do something different. There's no way that I would have that was
you know, that was never part of the Michael Nyman prescription. I was forced to do that because something external, namely this film with this particular needs to delineate a particular character, forced me to do that. But once I'd done it, it's now become part of my box of tricks, say. So, you know.
Per tant, seria bona part de barreja de natura i opció. Sí. And then the second question. Yeah. Yeah, this morning you've talked about music at the service, putting music in the service. But then there are also there is often that you do music for its own sake, music.
Yeah.
And then how would you define yourself? Because in respect of films or so, that's something different. How would you?
But you know what I was trying to stress this morning is that, you know, within films, I define myself by accepting the outside definition or the outside impetus, the need to write something for someone else, and yet managing to translate what is required of me by the director or by the opera writer, to translate that into my own language. And so this is a constant stimulation, it's a constant fight, but it's also a constant stimulation to constantly create Michael Nyman. Sometimes it comes easily, sometimes I don't have to think about it, sometimes I think I really have to kind of struggle to follow the instructions in my own
language. But when there is no translation at all, which language do you speak?
But it's basically the same. It's basically the same language, and every piece of music I write has some kind of constraints. If I write a string quartet, what are the constraints? Four instruments, and a kind of consistent history going back to the 18th century. So there's a kind of cultural history that I either want to avoid or to disregard or to accept, so it's kind of complicated. When I wrote my first string quartet, I was so overwhelmed by the history of the string quartet that I decided to use music from the early 17th century, a piece by John Bull. Which had nothing to do with the string quartet and was a keyboard piece of keyboard music and was a kind of folk tune. And I felt I needed, in order to eradicate late Beethoven and to eradicate Bartok and to eradicate Mozart and Haydn, I had to kind of go to a kind of preliminary kind of music that happened 150 years earlier. So that was kind of curious. It's a difficult question, and I need to.
But you wouldn't accept a label to. No.
You can give me labels.
Not even minimalist. No.
Well, I have to accept. You know, having since I kind of defined the concept of minimal music, and since I'm not stupid.
But you see, Marx was not a Marxist.
No.
You might not be a minimalist.
Did Marxism exist during while Marx was writing or not? Or is that something that came after he died? Which?
No.
After he died?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, minimalism happened before I became a composer. So, unfortunately, I've kind of created a structure that I feel that I'm still part of, because it would be stupid to
to deny that there are certain characteristics about this music that it doesn't share with what I call minimalism, what people still call minimalism. So that's my story. So,
just a very short question. Last question. If you consider the new French composers experimental musicians or vanguard?
Well, I mean, the problem with these definitions, with these kind of schools, is that minimal has a very specific meaning outside of music, and experimental has a very specific meaning outside of music, or as a process for creating music. Now, when I wrote the book Experimental Music, and it was part of a series of books, one was called Experimental Theatre, Experimental Film, Experimental Art, I didn't have to create a definition of what was experimental, because experimental music already existed. John Cage had invented the term. So in a way, that took away the responsibility for me deciding what was experimental about certain kinds of music and what was not experimental. So there was already a tradition created which I described and extended into the 1970s. And I could say that a lot of music that I call experimental music in that book is not experimental, and I could say that a lot of avant-garde music, the music of Stockhausen or Boulez, in a kind of scientific sense, is more experimental. But fortunately, I was in the position of not having to do that, because the formulation already existed, because experimental music already existed, so it made life easy for me. And it is sort of embarrassing when there's a kind of very simple-minded piece of music that I would say is within the experimental music tradition, when someone says, what's experimental about that? And I say, there's nothing experimental about it, it is within the experimental music tradition. So that...
Let's ask the question, the final turn. Has there ever been experimental music in different periods of history? Do you think so? Or is something contemporary or modern or so? Or in different periods there was also some...
Well, I mean, I would say, if you look at the music of... I mean, what I said before about, you know, given musical eras having an established musical practice, then experiment can only be heard as in the context of doing something very, very different within that musical practice. So you might say the music of Gesualdo within the madrigal tradition is experimental because it uses extreme harmonies that you don't find in anyone else's music. And there may be other music that might deviate from a kind of socially accepted time structure, but I can't think of any examples. That's a difficult one. I'm too tired to think about that. That's a very interesting question. I'm sure there's a lot of musical exceptions, maybe certainly in periods where, you know, when the diatonic harmonic system was being formulated out of 16th century polyphony
in those periods where the new accepted formulas have not really become formalized, then there might be very experimental shapes. I mean, while the symphony was developing it. So it's a kind of Darwinian thing, but I know it's not really. So when composers had ceased to write music like J.S. Bach and were making symphonic music which would be formalized by Haydn and Mozart, there were probably a lot of very, very strangely shaped pieces of music being made. And you could say that's truly experimental. You know, they were putting together a different kind of creative DNA or making totally different shaped animals. But unfortunately, most of that music is not very interesting. unfortunately, from what I remember. Okay.
Well, that's all. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.